Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today on our weekly roundtable. Well, here we go with impeachment. There are new evidence, wider implications, and the media are being limited with their access to senators during this process. We also discuss the last Democratic candidates' debate, including the now seeming split between the two progressive candidates, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Also, the continuing crisis in the Middle East. Trump's story keeps shifting as to why the United States assassinated General Soleimani, while today in Iran, tens of thousands heard from their supreme leader, who called the U.S. strike an act of terror. Our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these news headlines. President Trump's impeachment has opened in the U.S. Senate. Trump is charged with withholding approved military aid to Ukraine to pressure that country to investigate a political rival and with obstructing the House investigation into it. KPFA's Kate Eder reports.
The seven House managers, including Congressman Adam Schiff, will prosecute the case in the Senate.
Wherefore, President Trump, by such conduct, has demonstrated that he will remain a threat to national security and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office, and has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law.
Opening arguments in the trial will begin next Tuesday. The Senate will need to pass a resolution dictating the rules for the trial before opening arguments begin. Most likely, each side will have 24 hours to make their case, spaced out over several days. Senators will then have 16 hours, again spaced over several days, where they can submit questions to both sides. This is how the process worked during Bill Clinton's impeachment trial in 1999. It's unclear exactly how long the impeachment trial will last. Reporting for KPFA Pacifica Radio, I'm Kate Eda.
Iran's supreme leader lashed out at Western powers during Friday prayers in Tehran. It's the first time he's led prayers in 8 years. He dismissed what he called American clowns, who he said pretend to support the Iranian nation but want to stick their poison dagger into its back. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei used his rare appearance at the weekly prayers to say Iran would not bow to U.S. pressure after months of crushing sanctions and a series of recent crises, from the killing of a top Iranian general to the accidental shootdown of a Ukrainian passenger plane. Khamenei called Britain, France, and Germany enemies who could not be trusted. The European powers have been trying to convince Iran to remain in the nuclear deal it agreed to in 2015. His translated remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
They are deceitful in their negotiations with us. A steel hand in a velvet glove. They can't be trusted. We have no problem with talks, but not with the U.S.
Tensions between Iran and the United States have steadily escalated since President Trump withdrew from the nuclear accord, which had imposed restrictions on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for the lifting of international sanctions. Iran withdrew from the agreement following a U.S. drone strike that killed top General Qasem Soleimani earlier this month. The U.S. military said today that several soldiers were screened for concussions and sent to Germany for medical treatment as a result of an Iranian missile attack at U.S. bases in Iraq done in response to the U.S. killing of an Iranian commander. As Iran braced for a counterattack, the Revolutionary Guard shot down a passenger plane shortly after it took off from Tehran's international airport last week, mistaking it for a U.S. cruise missile. Most of those killed were Iranians. Researchers meeting in Paris said Thursday that wildfires around the world are surging in number, size, strength, and destruction, driven partly by global warming, while ever more people and their homes lie in the path of danger. Fire experts said cutting fire losses and risks is proving to be a gargantuan task, not least because communities, whether in Australia or California, like to live near forests and have so far been little deterred by the growing threat. That's presenting a host of challenges, from insurers suffering increasingly crippling losses to firefighting managers who have to decide where to deploy limited resources. Nowhere has the problem been more evident than in Australia, where wildfires, many out of control in the hottest and driest year on record, have burned through every state in the last 2 months. The blazes have now consumed 42 million acres, about 2,800 homes, and killed 28 people. Hospital giant Kaiser Permanente today pledged $25 million to a new California state fund aimed at getting people off the streets. Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order last week creating what he proposes to be a $750 million fund that providers could use to pay rents, subsidize affordable housing, or help board and care homes. Kaiser said its donation is one of the first of its kind from the private sector. In a statement, the Oakland-based nonprofit hospital chain said safe and stable housing is key to a person's physical, mental, and social health. Governor Gavin Newsom wrapped up his week-long homelessness tour of the state Thursday in Oakland. And as Christopher Martinez reports, the governor previewed trailers he plans to use to house homeless families.
At the beginning of January, Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order to expedite the use of public land to help expand homeless programs, along with a challenge to cities and counties to partner with the state.
Right here in Oakland, in Alameda, $38 million will be distributed in real time to meet this crisis head on. Some $19.7 million is available today, immediately, for the city of Oakland.
The Oakland event showed off more than a dozen former FEMA trailers that will be used to house homeless youths and families. Governor Newsom says the Oakland trailers are just a start, with action needed at all levels of government, including the federal government. Newsom's executive order sets a January 31st deadline to make state properties available as housing options for the homeless. His homelessness proposals in the state budget will be considered by lawmakers as they debate the budget for the next fiscal year. Reporting from Oakland, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and it is our weekly roundtable. On Thursday, January 16th, the historic impeachment trial of Donald Trump kicked off as the articles of impeachment long held by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi were finally submitted to the Senate. The Senate swore in Chief Justice John Roberts to preside over the impeachment trial, as senators also took a constitutionally required oath to administer impartial justice in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. Earlier in the day, House impeachment managers presented to the Senate the two articles of impeachment, reading the articles of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Those overseeing the impeachment trial are set to prosecute the case against Trump when the trial officially begins next week on Tuesday, January 21st. The Senate has issued a summons to Trump, who was until Saturday, January 18th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time to respond, this according to the New York Times. Now, earlier this week, House impeachment investigators released a new set of evidence that was obtained by Lev Parnas, an indicted former associate of Donald Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The evidence, which included voicemails, photos, and text messages between Parnas and high-level Trump aides, reveal just how far Donald Trump and his administration were willing to go to dig up dirt on Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Text messages, according to Politico, show potential surveillance of the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and this while she was still actually on the ground in the Ukraine. Now, the Ukraine, they are now investigating this. Meanwhile, Trump and his vice president, Mike Pence, have both issued statements claiming they don't know Parnas, dismissing his allegations. But there are several photos of Trump and Parnas looking very happy and looking very chummy together. Within the Senate, there's growing controversy over whether witnesses should be called and if so, when. Trump-aligned Republicans, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, are anxious to quickly acquit Trump, while others want to leave the potential for witnesses on the table. Senator Susan Collins from Maine announced in a statement on Thursday, January 16th, that she was likely to support calling witnesses after the initial phase of the trial. Also on Thursday, the FBI visited the home and business of Connecticut congressional candidate Robert Hyde in the wake of the released text that suggested Hyde was potentially monitoring the former U.S.-Ukrainian ambassador. And in May 2019, in a twist to all this, Hyde was mysteriously removed by police from Trump National Doral, Miami, in Florida. Now, meanwhile, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has said that Donald Trump broke the law in withholding Ukrainian aid. And it remains to be seen if any of this will come out in the Senate trial. Let us go, before we welcome and have our panelists weigh in, let us go now to a clip from CBS on the impeachment process.
The interesting thing is, when you think about it, is that the House part of this proceeding is sort of like an indictment. It's the equivalent to what we prosecutors used to do when we bring charges. Then this is supposed to be analogous to a trial. And at a trial, normally, if it were a normal criminal trial, you would have it's all about the facts. It's all about figuring out what happened and having a jury fact finders figure out what happened. If that's the case, then we really need witnesses. Now, if they want to say no matter what, even if the facts you say are true, there's no impeachable offense, well, that's different. Mm. So the thing is, if they decide to dismiss the charges before hearing any evidence, that is essentially saying we don't think, even if this happened, that it's an impeachable offense. And so I think that should be clear. Republican senators should realize what they're saying. Mm. That is the message. This is not an impeachable offense. It is not impeachable for a president to use his position for personal gain.
Explain to our viewers actually how this is different from a trial that you might witness here in New York City versus what we'll see in the Senate.
Right. So the rules of a normal trial are set. They're set by the legislature or the court. In state courts, frequently courts have their own rules. And their rules of evidence and their rules of procedure. This is a situation in which, oddly, the jurors are also the people who set the rules.
Move your hair a little bit.
Yeah, are also the people who set the rules. So, in that way, it doesn't follow those rules. Some much can happen behind closed doors. Some things will be presented to the public. Some things won't be presented to the public. And if there's a real political interest in and a majority to back that interest in just shutting this thing down, that's what will happen. And so it isn't the kind of procedure we're used to seeing, where there are two sides who have equal opportunity to kind of war it out.
All righty, there we go. I'd like to welcome our panelists. A lot to unpack here. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. She is based in Mexico City. She's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura Carlson, welcome.
Thanks very much, Margaret.
Jackie Goldberg, we'd like to welcome her. Jackie Goldberg is a governing board member for the Los Angeles School Board, District 5. She is a former member of the California State Assembly. Jackie Goldberg had previously served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Before being elected to the council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Dr. Gerald Horn, the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books. His most recently published books include White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela, and Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. He's also the author of Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, and also The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and this is your first time with us for this new year, so we're happy to have you. Dr. Horn. Yeah, he writes way faster than any of us could read. And I don't even think that. Let's do a little test now. Dr. Gerald Horn, how many books have you actually written?
Well, I think your description of 30 plus is accurate.
In other words.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? Anyway, okay, yeah, Dr. Gerald Horn. So, Laura Carlson, starting with you. You know, one has to wonder what people south of the border or people generally think about what is happening now in the U.S. I mean, Donald Trump has been impeached. Everybody's going on about a trial in the Senate. It's clear that this is going to be a very different trial than what one sees in court, where the jurors are supposed to be. You know, they're not supposed to have a position on their view, you know, before hearing the case, even though the Senate, sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts, did have to swear that they would be impartial or some words along those lines. So this is really an odd situation because there's a huge battle going on as to whether this really damning new evidence, the evidence before was damning enough, but with this new evidence coming in, that the Republicans are blocking it. And not only are they blocking it, but they're also blocking access, reporters' access to senators throughout this process. Laura Carlson.
There's been a lot of interest abroad, as there has been within the United States, in the impeachment trial, although people both abroad and at home are very clear that they need 67 votes to actually remove Donald Trump from office, and with not a single Republican breaking ranks, no matter what the evidence that comes in, because they've demonstrated an unconditional allegiance to Donald Trump in many points, actually demonstrating a betrayal of U.S. principles and laws. So no one's expecting that to happen, which makes the trial... which makes the trial not an actual exercise in the possibility of removing the president, and everyone's aware of that, but an exercise in bringing to the fore some of the issues of corruption and illegality within this administration. Since the primary impact that people are looking at has to do with the impact it'll have on the upcoming elections this year, that's really what people are looking at. With this new evidence, we have the text messages that are indicating between Lev Parnas and Robert Hyde in particular that are indicating the illegal surveillance of the Ukrainian ambassador, with now the Ukrainian police investigating that. And there's a very important statement by Lev Parnas saying he, Donald Trump, was aware of all my movements. So if there were a real trial on this and not a trial that's completely subject to the discretionary rules of Mitch McConnell, you know, that would be one of the key points, what he knew when. And it seems to be pretty clear that Donald Trump, as more and more evidence, and especially this new evidence comes up, did know exactly and was orchestrating exactly what was going on there. Now, the Government Accountability Office report is extremely important as well, because essentially what it concludes is that it's illegal to withhold aid that's already been appropriated to a country because of political, personal, or, you know, presidential whims, basically. The Office of Management and the Budget was accused in this, not directly the president, but the quote itself was that the president cannot withhold aid. And of course, that OMB office is within the White House. So the White House is beginning to come up with this excuse that that the accusation is against the OMB and not them, but it's a very weak excuse on any, whether you're looking at the way that it's structured or whether you're looking at actually what happens. This means that what we were hearing in the clip about impeachable or not impeachable is now going very, very heavily to the side of impeachable, because it's actually talking about an illegal act of the government. And in fact, the Los Angeles Times this morning, the editorial is, yes, Trump broke the law. So we can anticipate that that GAO report will have a major impact. There's increased pressure to subpoena, if there's a possibility of doing that, Mulvaney, the former White House chief of staff. The Democrats have requested four witnesses. And even though it takes 67 votes to remove Trump, it only takes 51 for Democrats to, for the rules to be, to allow witnesses. And as you mentioned, there's indications that several Republicans would be leaning toward allowing witnesses. What Klobuchar said in the debate is true, that if there are no witnesses, she said they may as well make him king. And I think that there are people, even including some on the other side of the aisle, that believe that that would be a travesty. So the big question in the air now is to see if there will be witnesses called in that process. There's some indications, according to experts, that the appointment of managers by Nancy Pelosi, of people with real litigation skills and with law enforcement skills, indicates that she has an expectation that there's at least a possibility of a real trial. Because if it were a show, you would have show-type people in those offices, and she's looking at people who can really litigate. Again, this is really up to Mitch McConnell. The Constitution says very little about this process, and so we're subject to the power of the Republicans within there.
Yeah, and Jackie,
corruption is the larger issue.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Laura Carlson. Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think the outcome is inevitable, so we have that to begin with. The real question is whether or not the public is going to have an opportunity to learn more about what happened, or whether they're not. I think it's still only 50-50 that there'll be witnesses or anything else, but it's a very, very short process, because McConnell is very committed to getting beyond this, mostly to protect his own members. I mean, I think he's actually now worried more about his members than he is about the president, because there is an election coming up, which, depending on how people perceive the role of Republicans in this particular instance, might affect those that are in trouble already. And you can see this best in Susan Collins. You know, she went from having a 78% favorable rate to now having a 42% favorable rating in her own state. After the Kavanaugh stuff, when she pledged, remember, that she would never do anything to hurt Roe versus Wade, ha, ha, ha. So that means that what we're really looking at are vulnerable Republicans, and then people like Alexander, who are those few older Republicans still left in the Senate who believe in the rule of law over their own personal careers. That's really been the problem from the very beginning. This is really for the Senate Republicans, about themselves, not about the president, not about the country, really not about anything, because they are very vulnerable. They know that the base for Trump, if he tells them this senator was a traitor to me and the party, they will put a Republican in the primary against them, and they'll get rid of them, and they know that. And so they are weighing not their conscience, but their political futures. And that's kind of the travesty that makes us all very worried about whether democracy is very real in America, or whether always looking for how to save your own particular seat will become the most important asset for an elected official. You can see this in state legislatures. You can see this around the country, that where there is a powerful force of right-wing money and influence, you cannot rely on any of those people to use conscience to make decisions about what's happening in this country. That level of corruption is deeper than it has been in any time in my lifetime, And it really portends some very serious problems for the future, no matter how this particular trial comes out.
Yeah, and just to remind, thank you for that, Jackie, remind our audience that Trump's impeachment came after the official House investigation that found he had solicited foreign interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election to help his reelection bid, and later obstructing the inquiry itself by telling his aides to ignore subpoenas for documents and testimony. And the Trump administration withheld nearly $400 million in military aid and an invitation to the White House of the Ukrainian President Zelensky as in order to influence the Ukraine to investigate the Bidens, Joe Biden and his son, and his son working with Burisma. And Trump also wanted Ukraine's new president to investigate the unsubstantiated claim that the Ukraine, not Russia, was behind the effort to influence the 2016 presidential election. And now there are reports that the Department of Justice, there's some investigation that's restarting, or there's now starting to go after James Comey, the FBI, head of the FBI that was fired by Trump. So they intend to really keep this stuff going. But, you know, Dr. Gerald Horn, I remember after the Rodney King uprisings, the uprisings that followed Rodney King, and some people were involved in trying to negotiate a gang truce here in Southern California. And I remember meeting with some of the young warriors. Some people refer to them as gangs. And they were saying, you know, Margaret, they call us gangsters, but this is a gangster state. And they were referring to the United States. And one has to now look at what is happening, because it really seems like there is mob rule going on. I mean, the U.S. ambassador literally had to flee because she was warned she was in danger. Get on the next plane and get out. And now we're getting some of that information. And it seems as though Trump's prediction that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, he'll still get elected. This seems to be bearing out. But Gerald Horn, your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I agree that what happened to Ambassador Yovanovitch in Ukraine may be the most chilling aspect of this entire tawdry chain of events. The fact that she felt her life was in danger and had to flee her post in the middle of the night. And apparently the threats were coming from some of Mr. Trump's comrades, or some of his comrades in the Republican Party, including the rather curious Robert Hyde, based in Connecticut, who is a leading member of the Republican Party in Connecticut. I think that this also underscores why the Democrats felt they had to rush through this impeachment, even though revelations are still trickling in, because they felt that they had to throw obstacles in the path of the White House, not only because they were conspiring still with foreign powers to interfere in the 2020 elections, but also who knows what other figures are being threatened, and the Democrats felt they had to put the spotlight on the White House perhaps to deter them. We also see that the Democrats feel that this impeachment process will force some tough votes in the Senate that could jeopardize the reelection chances not only of Susan Collins of Maine, but Senator Gardner of Colorado, perhaps Senator Tillis of North Carolina as well. Likewise, I'm not sure, however, if calling witnesses such as the SAC National Security Advisor, John Bolton, will work, because the Republicans say, well, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If you call Bolton, we'll call Hunter Biden, the son of the vice president, who, as you know, was receiving a hefty retainer from the Ukrainian energy company. Mr. Trump says that he was trying to ferret out that alleged corruption, and that's why he was pressing President Zelensky in Kiev. But in any case, even though there are Democrats who feel that that's a fair trade-off, they'll take their chances with Hunter Biden coming before the Senate so that they can get a swing at John Bolton. I'm not so sure if that's going to work out, given all of Hunter Biden's problems. Also, they're talking about calling Adam Schiff, the House prosecutor, the congressman from Southern California, as a witness, alleging that he was somehow conspiring with the whistleblower who blew the whistle on Mr. Trump in the first place. I'm not sure how that vote is going to work out either. So I think listeners should buckle their seatbelts. There's a rough ride ahead, although the key factor is that Mr. Trump's base is not crumbling, and that bodes well for him for November 2020. And as well, if he is not convicted, he will claim that he has been exonerated, and Mr. Trump's credulous base will probably go along with that to the detriment of the rest of us.
Right, and one could only hope. I mean, Nancy Pelosi was roundly criticized for even delaying getting the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. But a lot of people are saying, we discussed this a little bit last week, and Jackie Goldberg was making this point as well, that it was really a clever move because it did allow for more of this information to emerge and for the public itself to see the weight of the evidence against Donald Trump. Now, whether they decide that he still should be the so-named leader of the free world, you know, remains to be seen. But certainly the evidence that's coming out clearly shows a mob, a White House organized like the mob, with threats being made against people, all kinds of illegal activity going on. And just in terms of other presidents who were impeached, we know in 1816, Donald Trump, one of his favorites, Andrew Johnson, was impeached and charged with breaching the Tenure of Office Act, but the Senate narrowly acquitted him by one vote. In 1998, Bill Clinton was impeached, but he was also acquitted by the Senate. So the Senate basically hasn't found anybody guilty, any of these. This is the third Donald Trump. Nixon in 74, he would have been impeached, but he resigned before the House could move ahead with that. So it remains to be seen. Dr. Horn, you're right. We'll hold on to our seats. We'll see what happens next week. And also in the next round, we'll be talking about the presidential race. And of course, there's a connection with all of this and the presidential race. But before we do that, we'll take our station break and we'll be right back.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
We're gonna run to, we're gonna run to, all on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock.
Oh, the late, great Nina Simone, Sinner Man. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. We're also across the nation and worldwide on SoundCloud. And our tradition, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners today in Columbus, Ohio. Our listeners in Columbus, Ohio. And also today, we would like to give a shout out to our listeners in Turkey. Yes, we do have some SoundCloud listeners on Turkey. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We are now going to be talking about the debate that took place on Tuesday. I think it was January 14th, the Democratic candidates. And the mass media, they were really hoping for some blood to draw, you know, some red meat with this dispute that busted out when Elizabeth Warren said that in a private one-on-one conversation with Bernie Sanders, he said for 2020, he did not think that a woman could be elected. And of course, Bernie Sanders has denied that. We don't want to just talk about that in terms of the debate, because I'd be interested to hear what each of you thought about the debate itself. But let us go to a clip about the growing tensions between Warren and Sanders, and also what was said in that very awkward moment after the debate.
The race for the White House and the growing tension between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders. And you'll remember that moment at the end of the debate when Warren refused to shake Sanders' hand. So much lip reading afterward, but that's needed no longer, because tonight the audio has been released. But who does this feud really help? Here's Lindsay Davis.
This was the moment millions watched. Elizabeth Warren refusing to shake Bernie Sanders' hand after the Democratic debate. And tonight we're finally hearing that tense exchange.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that discussion. You called me a liar. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
Overnight, CNN released that audio. While neither calls the other an outright liar on the debate stage, Sanders did deny telling Warren a woman could not win the election.
Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. Hillary Clinton got 3 million votes, more votes than Trump. So who believes that a woman can't win? Of course a woman can win.
On Capitol Hill today for the impeachment trial, Warren wasn't taking questions about Sanders.
Senator, have you had a chance to speak?
Sanders was also pressed about the exchange with Warren.
Have you spoken to Senator Warren since the debate? Have you resolved anything there?
No, we haven't spoken.
Do you think it was a miscommunication?
A coalition of progressive groups is now calling for unity. There is concern that this rift could divide that wing of the party and give a boost to their more moderate rivals. They're hoping to move past the sparring of recent days and quickly, David.
All righty. And, you know, I'd really hope to be able to focus on some other things that happened in the debate. And Laura Carlson, I'd be interested to know from each of you what stood out, what jumped out at you. But however, this whole flap between Warren and Sanders has really taken off. I mean, in a new poll, a Reuters Ipsos national poll shows that Sanders has been climbing and is now tied with Biden among registered voters. That Reuters poll actually shows Sanders 20%, Biden 19%, and Warren 12%. I think this poll, I don't know if this poll was influenced, actually. I'll have to dig into that, and maybe our trusted assistant or producer there can look in to see if this happened after the debate. I think so. So it may have a reflection about how or how not that flap influenced the poll results. So, Laura Carlson, you weighing in on this particular flap, who do you think gains from it? And also anything else that jumped out at you from the debate?
I think that this flap, you know, between the two candidates was really set up by CNN in a way that did a great disservice to Democratic voters and to voters in general. This was a time when it was very important for the Democratic Party, despite the fact that there's six competing candidates, to set forth a strong vision of America, the United States, at a crossroads, that this should be what is at the center of the specific issues, that Trump and company are a threat to peace in the United States and abroad, that they betrayed democracy through violently constructed exclusions and fortified exclusions and discriminations, and that they're fomenting division within the communities. And then this comes up, and it really underlines how superficial the debate itself was, because it centered on, could a woman win? A woman as a stereotype, not a human being, and her ideas and what she's proposing to the voters.
Yeah.
You know, who can beat Trump? Who can bring the party together? And it really brings up a lot of issues that we've seen in other countries. In Mexico, for example, the government achieved parity, gender parity, in both the cabinet and the Congress, historically, for the first time. And the first lesson was that parity, whether a person is a woman or a man, is by no means even a guarantee of gender justice or advances.
Right.
It doesn't go to the structural changes that are necessary. It doesn't go to who can end violence against women, who can create a more inclusive society. Even the childcare discussion within the debate, you know, it was focused on the cost, and it didn't even go into the larger question of what's a care economy sustained by women within a capitalist society. So there were a number of issues that we got cheated on within this debate, and especially when it got sidetracked into this kind of personalist you know, the fireworks between individuals that the press loves so much. The other thing that happened is that when the candidates of color dropped out, so did their issues, the ones that most affect them. And this, again, was in part because of the white male lens of corporate media and of CNN, but we didn't hear about voting rights and purging voting registries. We didn't hear about mass incarceration, police brutality, racism, and we didn't hear about immigration. There was virtually nothing on immigration. There were groups outside that were challenging Biden to stop the deportations because of his record. Under the Obama administration, there's a new caravan coming up to the border, and yet all of these kind of fell off the agenda as the debate went into this other territory. Even foreign policy, which took up a lot of the first part of the debate, there was nothing on Mexico. Mexico's a foreign country, and Trump has threatened to send in the army. He's threatened to build the wall and now got permission to do that, to take it out of the Pentagon budget. It's become a national security issue, and it's never even mentioned. On trade as well, you know, there was a discussion about the new NAFTA, but those deeper issues of equality and of others, they only came up basically in the closing statements of Elizabeth Warren and of Bernie Sanders. So I don't think that this debate will give much clarity to the many undecided, especially in Iowa with the February 3rd caucus coming up very shortly. I think that it will just entrench the two camps that are already defined, and it will do very little in terms of pushing the undecided.
Yeah, and Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts on this. You have been an elected official, you know, as a woman and as a gay woman, right? And I, you know, it's true, the media definitely wanted this fight to happen and extending it. It also is true that it was Elizabeth Warren that came out with this story a year after it happened. And one has to wonder, you know, why. But given all of that and given what Laura just said, we also don't want the issues that were dealt with or weren't dealt with to be overlooked by this particular flap. But it's worrying enough that progressive groups have now issued some kind of statement. I haven't read it yet, but I understand it basically is kind of like a call for a truce, saying it's not helping the progressive movement. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, I agree with everything that Laura said. You know, this is a manufactured difficulty. I don't understand what happened, why Elizabeth even brought it up, but I do know that when you are in a statistical tie, which the four top Democrats are in right now in Iowa, it's a statistical tie. Even though there's a difference in the numbers, the plus or minuses that come with statistics of polls means that they are actually all basically capable of winning the primary. So what that means is that your folks that run your campaign begin to look for ways for you to distinguish yourself from other candidates. And this has always been an issue that was going to come up somehow between Warren and Sanders, since their politics are very similar, except for the fact that of course, Warren says that you need to reform the market economy, and Bernie says that democratic socialism is the ultimate answer. That's a big difference, but to most voters, it's not a big difference. They see their policy issues as very similar. So what happens then is that probably somebody in Elizabeth's campaign said, well, why don't you just throw a little something at Bernie, not something serious, but just say, well, you know, once upon a time, he actually said that he didn't think that a woman could win to me, and that was probably not a good thing for him to have said. And so she throws that out, and he either doesn't remember it or doesn't remember that that's what he said. He said something different, but that's not what he said, which is very possible, by the way, on a conversation that's a year old. And in either case, what happens is the media then says, let's poke both in an eye with this and keep going. And I think that that's very unfortunate, but it's not unusual. This is a very difficult race when you don't have a real front runner. And Biden was at the beginning a real front runner. He is no longer that. He is now one of four seriously in consideration, at least in Iowa and probably in New Hampshire as well. And the result of that is that campaigns try to find ways to distinguish candidates one from the other. I think this is a stupid situation. I hope both of them will stop talking about this at all, because the fact of the matter is, let's say worst case scenario, that Sanders said was exactly what she said. He said in public that if that was the case, that's certainly not what I meant, because goddammit, Hillary run 3 more million votes than he did. Of course a woman can win. That should have been the end of it. That should have been the end of it. But now each of them is saying, you called me a liar. That's ridiculous. No, you didn't. You disagreed as to what you remember happened. That is not necessarily calling someone a liar. And when you begin to have that pressure on you, though, as the ending days toward the end of a campaign for in a primary come to, is very complex for a candidate, particularly ones who are now in a really struggle to see how this is going to move forward.
Yeah, and Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, a lot of people are saying, and I think there's a good case for it, is that they had to know that some kind of mic would pick up what was being said. And the optics of it, of Bernie putting out his hand and Warren, clearly she was furious. Bernie wasn't too happy, and Steyer is looking a little stunned by the whole thing. But Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, there's that going on with this presidential race and debate. But the Washington Post now has come out with a major article about a Washington Post Ipsos poll of African Americans nationwide. And basically, they are strongly anti-Trump and are saying that their main focus is to get rid of Trump. And a lot of people are saying that explains why Biden has is leading in the black vote of people 35 and above, because 35 young people among black people, Sanders is leading. So it really remains to be seen. But clearly, the black vote and black women's vote in particular is going to play an important role in it, as will the Latina vote. So the fact that they didn't even bother to mention immigration, despite all of what's going on, the separation of children and all of that, the wall, is really quite shocking. And I think Laura makes a point that Jackie agreed to on this. But Dr. Horn, your thoughts on all that?
I think that same poll also suggests that black voters, by a rate of 8 out of 10, feel that the current occupant of the White House is a racist. I'm detecting a certain amount of ferment and flux in the Afro-American community that is quite striking. I mean, I would point you to the 1619 Project of the New York Times, which seeks to connect the ills of today with the slavery of the past. And in many ways, these mostly black journalists who put out the 1619 Project are to the left of the U.S. left in terms of their critique of the creation myth of the founding United States in 1776. It's quite an extraordinary intellectual and political development that we're going to have to keep track of. Likewise, because of pressure from the black community, you saw that the billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who was not on stage but is shaping the race nonetheless, was forced to retreat from his stop-and-frisk policies, which targeted disproportionately black and brown youth while he was mayor of New York City. And likewise, he's been forced to defend his non-disclosure agreement with regard to women who sued him or his corporation back in a time when he was acting like some sort of gender cowboy, running roughshod over the rights and interests of his women employees. The Wall Street Journal reports this morning that even though Mr. Bloomberg was not on stage, that he's shaping the race by driving up television advertising costs and also by paying a pretty penny to staffers, which means that Warren and Sanders and all the rest have to match those kinds of rates that Bloomberg is paying, which means that he's really shaping the race, whether we like it or not. Now, concerning this Warren Sanders flap, I agree with David Sirota, a Sanders surrogate, who suggests that we really should be talking about Biden and his decades-long efforts to cut back on Social Security, or we really should be talking about Mayor Pete and his scandalous lack of experience and his unfortunate tenure with McKinsey, the consulting giant, where he was involved in cutting jobs. And we really should be talking about why it is that Cory Booker and Kamala Harris had to drop out of this race and why there were no candidates of color on the stage, despite the fact that the Democrats are heavily dependent, as the South Carolina primary will exemplify, on black voters in particular. But alas, unsurprisingly, none of those critical issues have reached the surface thus far.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, we just have a few minutes left, so we'll actually start with you and see if others will be able to weigh in. This is about the growing crisis with the U.S. and Iran. We did discuss it last week where you were not able to participate, but the official story surrounding the Iranian military general Soleimani's assassination by the United States keeps shifting. Trump claimed that Soleimani had been planning imminent attacks on four U.S. embassies, which then Secretary of Defense Mark Esper declined to defend. Representative Justin Amash from Michigan has since come out and said the claim about the embassies, quote, seems to be totally made up. And then according to an NBC News investigation released on Monday, January 13th, Soleimani's assassination was planned more than 6 months before. He and nine others were murdered by a U.S. strike on January 3rd, a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad, Baghdad's international airport. This, of course, was never mentioned by Trump. And also, what has remained on the down low that on the day of Soleimani's assassination, U.S. forces carried out another top secret mission against another senior Iranian military official in Yemen. This according to the Washington Post. They targeted Abdulreza Shilai, a financier and key commander to Iran's elite Quds force, who is based in Yemen. That was ultimately unsuccessful, but that had also been pre-planned. And now in breaking news, 11 military members were wounded. They are were taken to Germany and I think one other country for treatment. They're saying concussions, but that they're still really assessing their injuries. So Trump lied about that also, saying that no U.S. personnel were injured. So, Dr. Horn, I just wondered if you had some thoughts on that, but also just to share with our listeners that there is breaking news on the impeachment, because Alan Dershowitz and Kenneth Starr have now joined Trump's legal team. The disgraced Alan Dershowitz, who's tied up with the Epstein sex scandal. I mean, this is unbelievable. And Robert Ray also. But Dr. Horn, on the Iran, you might want to say something about Dershowitz, but just on the assassination.
Well, Dershowitz links both of these scandals insofar as 2 days after the act of war, the assassination of General Soleimani, Dershowitz had an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal basically justifying this act of war, which in fact is what it was. Iran demonstrated that it has a formidable array of missiles, which is one of the reasons you see these U.S. soldiers being treated for concussions. It could have been much worse. And I should also say that if General Soleimani is a terrorist, as Washington proclaims, because he has been involved in war, what does that say about David Petraeus or Stanley McChrystal? What would happen if the Iranians were to seek an assassination of the number two official of the United States government, Michael Pence, for example? I dare say that that would be viewed as an act of war. And with regard to the shooting down of the Ukrainian aircraft at Tehran Airport, well, the Iranians have yet to forget what happened in 1948 when a U.S. naval vessel shot down an Iranian civilian aircraft, leading to the death of 290 individuals, 66 children, with the naval commander basically getting a medal from the U.S. authorities. I should also say that we should not feel that this crisis is over. Recall what happened in 2012 when Israel was accused of assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists. There was not an immediate response, but eventually you had an attack on Israeli tourists in Bulgaria. You had an attack on Israeli diplomats in a territory ranging from former Soviet Republic of Georgia to Thailand. And I should also say that there are those in Washington, in the think tanks in particular, who feel that all of these crises in West Asia, between Iran, Iraq, Syria, et cetera, is really a distraction from what they consider to be the big enchilada, which is the confrontation with China. And I would really warn the leaders of the Israeli lobby, including Alan Dershowitz, that they should be very careful lest they be somehow scapegoated as China continues to motor ahead in the passing lane.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn also today, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei described the U.S. officials as American clowns. He said that the attack on Soleimani was an international terrorism. He criticized France, Germany, and the U.K. as lackeys of Trump, who cannot be trusted. This as he expressed condolences to the families of the victims of the plane crash that it seemed, according to the Iranians, was accidentally shot down, and really worked in Trump's favor, in the U.S. favor, because it really then sparked a new round of protests against the government of Iran by people upset by what happened with the airline. So, but I think you're right. This is not over. It remains to be seen, and we'll be following all of this. I also just want to quickly say that this thing about limiting press access during the impeachment hearings, we really have to watch out for that. This is the mainstream press. We know that alternative media have been under attack, but we see this. And then just yesterday, Arizona Senator Martha McSally, who wasn't even elected, she was defeated actually when she ran for Senate. She was appointed to replace McCain. I think it was to replace McCain. She called the CNN reporter Manu Raju, who just asked her if witnesses should be called. She said, oh, you're just a liberal hack. I'm not going to talk to you. And I saw that, and it really said something to me. He's a man of color. And I don't know if he wasn't a man of color, if she really would have responded with the, she might not have talked with him or said the question was irrelevant. But the way she spoke to him, I thought really reflected also, frankly, a piece of racism. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram, @SoTrueRadio. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.